Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. And this week we have a fascinating program. We have Rav Aaron Cutler, who's the CEO of Beis Medrash Gavoa, Lakewood Yeshiva, which is the largest yeshiva in the Western Hemisphere. And he'll be speaking about the current crisis that happened in Lakewood, a very contemporary current event. And we will have Rabbi Yitzchak Adlerstein. Rabbi Adlerstein will be speaking about Karov Lamalchus. You know, we have a president who has a son-in-law and a daughter who are Orthodox, they consider themselves modern Orthodox, and there have been stories about him flying on Shabbat, etc. Rabbi Yitzchak will be speaking about the halachic implications of that. You can listen to us every week on WMCA 570 AM, Matzah Shabbos, or you can always get go to our website, headlinestorah.com. We are starting to put in Mara Mekaymis for each show. So when we mention a Rashba, Rambam, Ramban, Ramchal, whatever it is, you go to the site. We have now curated all to one-stop shopping. You can go there, you can print it out, you can agree or disagree. We love when people disagree. The Koyach of Klal Yisrael was always the Koyach of discussion, argument, and debate. If you think I learned wrong shot in something, send us an email. We will be there to try to read as many of them as we can. Before we go to our guests, I would like to say two things. First, I'd like to put in a plug from Reb Shraga Feivel to tell. He bought Headlines and he wrote, "It changed the way I look at halacha. It was informative and interesting. And I urge you to go buy it while it's still on the shelves. It's selling out. Go grab one. It also makes a great gift." I would like to say something on the parsha before we go to our guests. You know, this week is the week of Parah Aduma, Chukas. And what was Parah Aduma? We took ashes, and ashes are a substance that comes after something is destroyed. It comes from ruins. The remains, the dictionary says, the remains of something destroyed. The remains of the human body or an animal creature after burning or cremation, the powdery residue left after the burning of a substance, and for the most part, you can't plant in ashes. It's good for nothing. It's the end. It's the wreckage. It's the ruins. The ultimate ruins, the ashes. And what do? We take Mayim Chaim, we attach it to Mayim Chaim, something that represents life. And what do we do? And it becomes a vehicle for Tahara. It purifies, and it allows people to re-enter society. We take ashes and we return them to the living. And I think there's a very profound statement here. You know, they brought the Kabbalah ring that the Parah, which is what the ashes burn the Parah Aduma to make it, there's Oisius Menatzpach. There are five letters in Hebrew, Mem Nun Tzadik, Pei and Chaf, all of which have two ways to write them. There is a standard way. And when they come at the end of the word, their shape changes. They become elongated. And at that point, it's a sign the word is over. Terminal point. Chalas. Done. When you take the gematria of Menatzpach and the number of the letters, it equals Parah, 285. So to show that the Parah Aduma rents a terminal point, ashes is when there's no hope. It's all over. It's absolute loss. Death, loss, destruction, failure. And what is the chiddush of Parah Aduma? We can take this loss, attach it to Mayim Chaim, and presto, it turns into a vehicle of Tahara. And I think there's an incredible message there. You know, in Judaism we say, in effect, never waste a setback. Every setback can become a vehicle for something incredibly profound, living, transformative, a metamorphosis. That's the message of the Parah Aduma.
So let me share with you a story. It's a contemporary story, but it's a good example of how, as Jews, we understand it's in our blood that we don't waste a setback. So there's these two young gentlemen. One of them, his name is Brian Chesky, who's Jewish. And he moves to San Francisco. And you know, the rents in San Francisco are astronomical, like New York City. You know, a person's not supposed to spend more than 30% of their income on housing. New York, you know, it's so expensive, you could spend 40, 50, 60. So these two young fellows, they move to San Francisco, and they're looking forward to a, you know, exciting life. They're going to be involved in big business or whatever these gentlemen wanted to do, and they couldn't afford their rent. So one of them had an idea. He said, let's put an ad in the paper, and we go away every second weekend. There's one room we don't use so much. We'll rent it to somebody else. And they did, and they rented it. They were successful, and they were able to pay their rent. It made life a lot easier. And one said, you know, I bet there's a lot of people like that. So they started advertising. If you have an apartment that you leave, you know, it's free once a month, or you have an extra room, maybe you want to rent it to a tourist. And it got busier and busier. And from that sad little situation where they had to rent out a room to make ends meet, that inspired a little business called Airbnb, which today has a valuation of something like, I don't know, $30 billion. But that's an example of it's ashes, it's a setback. Let's not waste it. Let's step it into an idea, make something great out of it. And I think it's a little relevant to what we're going to discuss tonight with Rabbi Aaron Cutler. You know, Lakewood had a setback this week, a humiliation of sorts, something very painful and hurtful. And we can use that as an opportunity for change, to look at it and examine, and how can we improve? How do we use this as an opportunity to step forward and create something positive out of it? Let's take the ashes of the Pura, of the Isis Manatzbach, the dead end, and be mechabrit to Mayim Chaim to create a new idea, an examination, a new path forward. Lakewood, when Rabbi Aaron came, there was a minyan. And today is Kenai Nahara, Berivavais, right? It's the bracha was Niskayim. So how do we change that? How do we, let's not waste this opportunity. Let's go to our guests.
We have the honor of having with us on the phone Rav Aaron Cutler, who is the CEO of Yeshivas Beis Medrash Gavoa. He's the grandson of the great Goyin Rav Aaron Cutler, the son of the Rosh Hashiva, Rav Shneur Yartzai, was this week. Welcome, Rav Aaron.
Rav David, how are you?
Baruch Hashem. So this was a rough week in Lakewood.
Yes. Sad week for Klal Yisrael.
So I want to ask you a question, and you know, I see the press is making a lot of hay of this. And, you know, I Googled it, and there's, according to the National Review, which is a very respected paper, there is $139 billion a year of improper payments across federal programs. That's $139 billion, $139 million. So they found a group of bad apples in Lakewood, a city that probably has 50 or 60,000 Orthodox Jews. They found 10 or 20 or 30, whatever the number is, it's some low-digit number, who've taken $2 million or $3 million or $4 million out of the $139 billion and trumpeted them across the papers. Do you think that's fair?
Well, David, you're bringing up a phenomenal point, interesting point. Last year in New Jersey, there was $781 million worth of Medicaid fraud alone. And so the Medicaid fraud in these allegations certainly are a very small percentage of that. And, of course, we know that Lakewood is today one of the largest cities in New Jersey. I think the question is less for us as from Yidden whether the way the press bandies this about is fair or not, but the much more fundamental question for ourselves is, what can we learn from this as a community? What do we need to do better? Where can we be mechazik our chinuch system? And I think that any of the gedolim, I think of my father, I think of Rav Aaron, the famous story of Rav Aaron with the architects had made a painting, a rendering for a new building. And they brought him the rendering of the building, and in the rendering, there was a big, beautiful tree next to the building, and Rav Aaron knew the site, and he knew that tree did not exist, and there would be no way they could plant such a large tree. He said, "What's this?" They said that this is the tree. He says, there's no tree there. They said, "But it makes the picture look good." And he immediately reacted. He says, "This is sheker." He says, "I don't want to see it even." So I think that the Gedolim, the Hadracha, we live by Das Torah. I think the Hadracha of the Gedolim would clearly be to us, let's not focus on the external elements of this. It's not important for the moment what the media is saying. And I should say it's not important for the average person. Maybe it's important for those who are involved in media or actively involved in community to speak up and to speak to the media if they see and when they see bias in the media. And there's certainly a lot of that. But more importantly for us is to look at ourselves and say, starting from the moment the child is in the cradle through their entire life, what can we do better? What's the mussar we want to learn from this?
That's a fantastic story with Reb Aaron. So let me ask you a question, Reb Aaron. What would you say to people in Lakewood or all over who their children say, I saw this in the news. What should our response be?
One of the most important aspects of from life today that may not get the attention that it deserves is really the Limud HaMussar. And Limud HaMussar is about Cheshbon HaNefesh. It's not just opening a sefer and looking in the sefer and reading the words. It's about that Cheshbon HaNefesh of what, who am I? What is my tafkid in the world? Why did Hashem put me here? What does Hashem want me to do? What is my purpose? What are my aims? What am I aspiring toward? If a person has Cheshbon HaNefesh, then regardless of their particular aims in life, whether they want to build a business, whether they want to be involved in chesed, whether they want to be a marbet Torah, whatever they're going to want to do, they're going to want to do it for the right reasons, hopefully, because they will have engaged in such intensive cheshbon nefesh. Without cheshbon nefesh, a person doesn't make a difference what their endeavor is. They can lose the purity of their intentions, or they could be distracted along the way while they're pursuing what are really beautiful goals. And if you think of a family that children, parents, most from families, ruba de ruba, they want to live beautiful lives, they want to live Torah lives. So what happens when a person makes a mistake? There's a Yetzirah, there's temptation. And without Cheshbon HaNefesh and without the Mussar aspect, the Yetzirah, he's always going to come after you. And if he can't get a person in one aspect of their lives, he's going to try to get the person in the other aspect of their lives. And there's very famous stories from the Balei Mussar about how the Yetzirah would choose a different guise to every person. And I think what tends to happen is that we assume that because the person is from, they're not going to have a Yetzirah. We think, I'm from, I learn, I'm Shomer Shabbos, I keep kashrus, I'm makpid, I even have the appropriate chumras, which is a beautiful thing. Chumras shows that a person loves the mitzvah. He's not trying to get away with it. It's a form of hider mitzvah. So a person lives that way, and then we assume we could relax because we're not going to have Yetzirah. And the Balei Mussar tell us and Chazal tell us that's really not true. Yetzirah is going to work, and not only that, he's going to work harder because the goal for the Yetzirah, in a sense, is much greater. And it's sad that as a community that we're not doing more on the Mussar side, on the Cheshbon HaNefesh side. And I don't think any of us question that any of the Gedolim, any of the great people who we look up to as a society, they were known for their Ehrlichkeit. They were known for their absolute focus on being Ehrlich and judicious in every word and in every action. But how did they get there? The way they got there was by such endless avodas Hashem, endless focus on refining themselves. And again, that brings us back to Mussar, where Mussar is such an essential component of a person's self-refinement.
So, Reb Aaron, let me ask you a question. How do we, what do you do as the CEO of the largest Torah Moshed in America and influential and really at, the press, you're a lightning rod. What do we do so that this doesn't happen again? What can we do?
I think the most important thing for us as a community, again, is not to look externally. not to look at, I'm being very specific, if a person is an Oscan, is involved with public life, and he sees bias in the media, there's an appropriate way to call it out, an appropriate way to speak to them, and to seek to prevent the blackening of the name of Torah Jewry in any way. But for the average person, what's really important to us is to make sure that we get our lives right. And to get our lives right means that everything that we do should have this cheshbon nefesh, mussar, gaining a real awareness and keeping a real awareness of who we are as a people. We're a Kadosh Baruch Hu's Am Segula. I said over a story yesterday of a man who related to me the first time he put on a yarmulke. He was not religious, and he was in his late 40s. And the first time he put on a yarmulke, he had no intention of becoming from, but he just wanted to see what it felt like. And he's a conductor of a great orchestra. And he comes in to conduct this orchestra. There are a few hundred musicians. And he walks in for the first time wearing a yarmulke. And he says the entire room was staring at him. And he can tell how subtly the mood in the room changed. And people's relationships started to shift to him. And he said, of course, within 5 minutes, somebody said, well, Rabbi, how are you today? He says, no, I'm not a rabbi. I'm not even religious. But he said, the power of the yarmulke, the power of standing up and saying, we represent Am Segula. We have to think about that. It could be something as small as you're driving down the road and you see a car trying to merge. And you say to yourself, I'm a from Yid. And I know we all think this way. But it's hard. We're in a rush. Everybody has a Yetzirah. I am the Am Segula. I am a representative. This is why I don't dress this way because my neighbors dress this way, or I don't dress this way because I want to get my children into school. I dress this way because I stand for something. Well, what do we stand for? We stand for being the Am Segula. That means our job is to represent Hashem in the world. If you're walking in an airport or in a store, or you're in line in the bank, any small action, that is who we represent. We're representing the Baruch Shleila. If we live with that awareness, we're going to be so much stronger when that Yetzirah comes. The Yetzirah is going to have such an uphill battle to try to distract us into doing the types of things that we're reading in the press.
Well, Rav Aaron, I have a question. I think that a few of the people who were pulled out were making millions of dollars a year, but those are the exceptions, right? The majority is the scrunched middle class. And when I say middle class, it's somebody who has 6 or 7 or 8 kids who could be earning between him and his wife $100,000 a year. And if you do the math, if you're earning $100,000 a year and you have 8 kids, that means you're paying $40,000 a year in tuition. That's at $3,500, which is the bare lowest minimum, right? So you're paying $40,000. So 40% of your income is going to tuition, right? You're paying $10,000 in taxes. You're left with $50,000, right? Now, $50,000, you have housing. Medical insurance is $20,000. So now you're left with $30,000 to clothe, feed, send to camp, pay utilities, a family of 8. It's just impossible. It doesn't work. And what happens is when people get desperate and they have to pay a doctor and they have to pay a kid's bill, they're going to steal because there is no brera. What are we as a community doing? You know, the Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim writes, he says, the nisim happened to Yechidei Segula. And as a community, we can't live on nisim. Even though we had Rabbi Eisenstein here 2 weeks ago, he said all parnas is a nes, and therefore we should ask no questions. But it's not a way the Rambam explains it. So what is a person who earns $100,000 a year, how does he survive? Because I don't think any of these people, or certainly the vast majority, want to steal. The vast majority do not want to commit any fraud. It's out of a sense of desperation. What is the solution to the person who's earning $100,000 a year, which in America is considered good, but with large families, the cost of living, kosher, schooling, it's triple. How do they survive?
One of the things, just as you mentioned about the cost of health care, one of the things we did here in Lakewood was to create a health care center that has a sliding scale, so a large family is typically eligible for reduced rates. I don't think there's any one big answer to a societal problem. I don't think any societal problem is one big answer. I believe the answers come in from small things. Do you remember, Reb David, when Agudas Yisrael so valiantly tried to create the Takanas Asanas?
Yeah, and I think it's an absolutely beautiful thing.
Yeah. At the time it failed, but it finally took off. And here in Lakewood, we have families coming in from Baltimore, from Los Angeles, for the Takana weddings. And the cost of weddings have come down in a massive way. So if anybody comes in and they tell me that they have the answer to this question of modern-day life, of how do we afford to live, I would check them twice before I let them into my house, because I can't imagine that one person has that answer. This is a challenge for a generation. It's the things that we do. If you're a young family out there, or an older person, and you have an idea, you think you can help people, you think you can bring down the cost of living, or you think you can in some way ease the burden of being a frum yid, the financial burden, then do it. Let's do it.
So Rabban, I think that if we don't address this, we're just denying. It's like we're putting Band-Aids on, because, again, I do believe that the majority of people, I live there, I know these people, they're Yireim, they're Shleimim, they're Iver, and very serious Yisurim, you know, that somebody who's Iver Gezel Akum, the Chacham Tzvi says he's Pasal Eidus, if any of these people were Eidim by a Chasana, they have to redo the marriage, possibly, right? They do it out of desperation, and the desperation is the math doesn't add up. And I wonder whether we as a community have to look at things like sending daughters to seminary for $20,000 or $25,000 a year. Like, why don't we speak out against it? If they said, if you don't bring down seminary costs to $10,000 a year, we, Rabbanim, will come out with a cherem. You can, you know, the Ger Rebbe, when they raised the price of Shtreimlich in Yerushalayim, came out and he said, if they don't lower the price, I will come to shul without a spadik.
Wow.
Changed it. I'm saying we should just line by line set together, the seminaries are killing you. Well, guess what? If they don't lower it, you will asser it. I mean, we could go through line by line and try to come up with an alpidera hateva deka answer, because again, like the Ram says, nisim do happen, but ain't saimchen al hanes, because if we want to avoid it, we have to go back to the reality. I cannot imagine how a person lives on $100,000 a year. It boggles the imagination. I just think putting Band-Aids on it is ultimately, it's going to explode again. It's inevitable.
David, allow me to respond on this from two very, very different viewpoints. Number one, and most important, is the more internal moral strength a person has when they have an assignment, the better the chances that they're going to make the right decision and not the wrong decision. Life is always going to have nesainus. From other Marishas, in the very first second of life on earth, there's always going to be nesainus. And if you read history, and I try to look a lot shalavicha to have a sense of history. You read history, in every generation there were major nesainus. And if it's not going to be this nesain, it's going to be a haskalah, it's going to be a communism, it's going to be something else that's going to come along. You know, in the 1600s, half of Klal Yisrael unfortunately left the doors of Klal Yisrael with Shapsi Tzvi. If it wasn't half, it was a little less. There's always going to be a nesain. What keeps us as the people in the face of the nesainus? And today's nesain, clearly, one of the major nesainus is Parnassa. What keeps us is that moral, internal moral strength. That's what we have to be machazik. So if you're asking me this morning, say, Aaron, do you have a solution for the financial troubles of Klal Yisrael? I do not. I don't think anybody does. But again, there are two things. Number one, most important, is we have to battle the Yetzirah. If today's Yetzirah is, and I'm not saying that it is, but if today's Yetzirah is in financial areas, then we have to rally to the call of the day and age, and we have to fight it, we have to battle it, we have to speak against financial improprieties, we have to upgrade the standards, we have to upgrade the social standards of the communities, we have to do everything we can to make it, to strengthen our people in the face of Nisayan. And second, it will be, I believe, the small things that matter. It will be a family moving to an out-of-town. It'll be a family not overpaying for a home. I'm not sure that the top-down methodology that you mentioned in Ger always works. I know it worked in Satmar. I'm not sure that it always works. Sometimes it helps us sort of bubbling up. I know Jungalite and Lakewood were upset that the style of the homes that were being built, the type of homes that were being built, were going upscale, more and more upscale. Now, obviously, the people building the homes, they're businessmen. They have a fiduciary responsibility to their partners, to the banks. They want to do the best that they can. But the people spoke up, just like the people of Lakewood spoke up for the Takana Chasanas. And just like so many other Kehillos have spoken up, saying it's okay to get a CZ instead of a diamond ring. I believe that in Satmar, there's most of the people buy CDs and they don't buy a diamond. It's the small things that happen. And those small things, when they happen, they can make the difference.
Reb Aaron, on the same theme, though, but the question is, can the leadership, as a community leader, could it be enacted to come from the top down? But let me give you an example. I have a brother-in-law here in Lakewood who's has, can I know her, 11 kids. He's a mamashah. He never took a penny from the government. I went to visit him. It was in the middle of the summer, and he's sitting and learning. The lights were off because he was learning by the window, and there's no air conditioning in the house. And it's clear that his attitude was, look, I wanted to learn Torah. It was the most important thing in the world to me. And I understood the sacrifices that have to be made for it. Wouldn't it be a good message if the Rabbanim, listen, this is a town of Torah. We want to have large families. We don't want to, say, have smaller families, even though they may be halachic right, because this is our way of life. But if you want to live here, you should live in a small house. If you want to be, you should sacrifice your air conditioning. This is a holy town. And if you want to be part of this town where we don't encourage, you know, college education, where we encourage large families, please adhere to the humbleness that must come hand in hand with the lifestyle that must come hand in hand. And if you reject it and want to start creating a rat race and a showy, really should not be in our town. Would that perhaps be a message that would help?
I don't think that the way the Rabbanim and the way we communicate has ever been to Yidden, you're not welcome here, but it's more leadership by example. So instead of coming in and saying, the person, you're not welcome here, we're not going to take you in, it's more leadership by example. And I think the leadership by example has been successful, and part of that success is bringing in many other families who want to live here and want to live here because it is a simpler lifestyle, because it's a less frantic lifestyle.
But there are huge houses, Reb Aaron, there are huge houses built in Lakewood. Wouldn't it
yes,
make
there
sense?
Are, there are,
it
but,
make
90,
sense to,
but they're
it make
the,
sense
they're
to
the
say,
minority.
But don't come here. If you want to live in that lifestyle, please do not come here. We embrace, we live in a spiritual standard, and you will pollute it, and there are going to be people whose children feel bad. Why? And they will end up, it will pervert and pollute our lifestyle. We, Reb Aaron, lived very humbly. He lived in a tiny little apartment. You can't have a havas olam hazeh and olam haba b'rishus echa, the sicer each other. So if we don't educate, Reb Aaron respectfully was against college, so then we should not let you at the same time say, don't pollute our community. Reb Aaron, what I'm suggesting is that it's if it's just a matter of musa, ultimately the inability to afford will burst. It's like being on a diet. I'm on a diet. You put a seven-layer cake. You go to a smorgasbord, a diet bus. When there's beautiful homes, unaffordability for basic things, medical.
But words are not enough. I go to the Shalom Zachars, and I go to the Briston here, and I go to the Simchas here. I'm around every day in Lakewood. And the average lifestyle here is not a lifestyle of Maestros, because the people are sacrificing, and even the working people, you know, of the seven families that are now in such trouble, five of them are working families, or six of them are working families.
Well, I think all of them are working families.
Maybe all of them even. So, and this goes back to the affordability, but I think the lifestyle here is definitely a much simpler lifestyle, and I think the people want to see more of that, and that's a good thing. The only area where I'm not fully in agreement is the Hashkafa and the Mahalach of Lakewood. I think of Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Moshe Feinstein. I think of my father, the great Rav Schneer, who you knew so well. Their style was not to say to people, you can't come. And they weren't in that top-down, very heavy, this is the way, it is my way, the highway type of people. They were more to elevate people, inspire people. Let's lift them up. If you're living here, come learn, come daven, come get involved in chesed. Let's do mitzvahs. Do you know how many kibbutz chains there are here? How many chesed organizations? How many people are involved? And when a chesed event comes, young light come, they'll give 50 cents if that's all they can afford. Even working people will come, they'll give $10 if that's what they can afford, or $5. To lift people up, the quality stroll is about elevating people.
Rav Aaron, let me ask you another question. I think that many of us of Orthodox, it's still fresh in our mind, as recently as, I don't know, 100 years ago, there was discrimination against, from the governments against Jews. For example, in Poland, Russia, if you could Google this online, a Jew was not allowed to be a member of a guild. They couldn't own land. They couldn't be a carpenter. They couldn't be a plumber. They couldn't be a glazier. They couldn't be a baker. There was a long list. They weren't allowed to travel. It was financial discrimination and oppression, and the government was seen as the enemy. I remember there's near my house, there's a Rebbe who lives. I went in once to daven there. I woke up late, and it was Hashanah Rabbah. I missed the I usually daven Ashkam. I missed my minyan. I went in there, and he was giving a speech between every one of the between every hakafa about the terrible, you know, this, you know, Nar Klal Yisrael, Abba the Goyim, and where does this come from? It comes from 2,000 years of gullus, of discrimination, of oppression, of financial denuding of assets. You know, like the Shach says in Shin Samachtes, he says, the mice, or in Shin Peches, he says in another place, he says, what was the mice? They would find an excuse and they would take everything away. They would they took all the assets, right? And that attitude, I think, has not left many of us, where we see the government as the enemy. We see the guy as the enemy. And it's like, when we're fighting yesterday's wars, it's very dangerous. When we're, you know, the Maginot, you know, France fell in World War II in a few weeks because of the Maginot Line. In World War I, it was all tanks. And so it was all trench warfare. They built a huge trench across France to stop trench warfare. World War II was about speedy tanks that just rumbled right over them. France fell in a few hours. We're fighting. We still have a mindset of from 2,000 years. I mean, this is, you know, you talk about a deep, with good, very good reason of oppression that came mitam hamedina, mitam hamalchus, and we're in a different world now where it doesn't, and many of us still see the government as the enemy. They're trying to take, and my point is it possible that 2,000 years has seared and left such an imprint that we transport, right, that same set of feelings to a government that is very kind, to the average guy who is not anti-Semitic, who's willing to work with you, and therefore it has ramifications. Is that a possibility?
I allow me to challenge the concept. I don't think the average firm person looks today, whether in Brooklyn or Williamsburg or Muncie, looks at the government as the enemy in any way. I think they're treated with respect. I think they're even treated with friendship and warmth and with a smile. So I'll never hear, and I certainly would hear, I never hear somebody come in and say, hey, I was in to get my license renewed, or I had an issue down at the hospital or at the Board of Social Services. Somebody looked at me askance because I was a religious Jew. You rarely, if ever, hear of such. And I don't think we look at the government as the enemy. I think if you go around Lakewood, everybody knows the police officers in the neighborhood. They know the government officials. They know the county officials. People are. It's a very friendly place. So I'm going to challenge that. I don't think that in most firm communities there's a sense that government is the enemy. And I people don't live with such a strong sense of history. So maybe if you think about it, yeah, I just read a book on one city in the Austrian-Swiss border, 1,000 years of history, and basically it was 1,000 years of the same limits, restrictions, zoning restrictions, all types of restrictions on the front, on the yidden of the town, and it was just over and over and over again. I feel like I'm reading like the nightmare that never ends, never stops repeating itself.
So if you're correct, why is there a certain callus when it comes to Gnevas Akum, Gezel Akum, Gnevas Das Akum, Dina de Malchus Adina? Where does that come from?
It's a faceless, to the degree that there is such, when there is such, I don't think it's widespread, but to the degree there is such, I think it's what we call the faceless victim. So nobody would steal a dollar from a little girl going to the grocery store trying to buy a lollipop. I mean, even a hardened mobster wouldn't steal from that little girl. But maybe the person is going to steal from the shopkeeper who sells. The mobster is going to hold up the shop because the shopkeeper is to him is less personal. And the stick-up artist is not going to stick up the corner grocery store that the mobster just held up, because it's also personal to him. And crime, there is this notion of the faceless victim. And people think, yeah, it's an insurance company, it's a bank, and they're kind of faceless and they're nameless. And then when you get to government, it feels to people like it's even more faceless and nameless. And maybe they think government anyways, what's the real difference that it's going to make? And this, the important thing for us to emphasize is, and we put this, Pavad put this in their statement yesterday, when you're taking money from the government wrongfully, the one who does that, it's as if you're taking from your neighbor and as if you're taking from your friend. It's not a faceless victim. It's a victim with a face, but you're not just stealing from the little girl going to the grocery store and the shopkeeper. You're stealing from everybody who's paying. And most importantly is, you're robbing, if one who does this, you have the potential, you're robbing the dignity of what it means to be a from yid, from yourself. And once you lose that, it's so hard to regain it. And of course, we then wake up and we read headlines in the papers, and what I read in the paper is the dignity, the pride, being a from yid, that gets robbed from us. So if a person goes ahead and has an insurance situation and he can figure out a dreidel, and he does it, Leolano, you're taking something away, not just from an insurance company that has owners and shareholders and investors and debt obligations from the many people, but you're also taking away from every firm you around you, and most importantly, from yourself, from your family, and from your children. So these are the types of things we need to think about, and we need to emphasize. There is no faceless crime in, I don't believe it's widespread, but when a person has the Yetzer Hara, and as you said before, it's under financial stress, the person is thinking about making that mistake. This is the type of thought you can think about that will prevent you from making that type of mistake.
Thank you very much. That was Rabbi Aaron Kotler, the CEO of Beis Medrash Gevaya. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Rabbi David. Have a wonderful day.
We have the honor of having with us on the phone from Los Angeles, Rav Yitzchak Adlerstein, who is the Director of Advocacy for the Simon Wiesenthal Center. He's also a professor of law at Loyola Law School, Jewish law. He's also the Mechaber of the Be'er HaGoyla. He did an adaptation in English. He wrote for Art Scroll. He did the English Ramban. And he recently came out with the Nesivah Shalom from the great Slonim Rebbe, who I had the privilege of getting a bracha from and meeting and hearing him speak. He did the Nesivah Shalom in English. I'm sure that's going to be a very big bestseller. By the way, I also want to mention he's the editor of and founder of Cross Currents, which is like a Torah blog. Welcome, Rabbi Adlerstein.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
So, Rabbi Adlerstein, anybody who is Jewish has seen in the news recently the fact that the President of the United States has a son-in-law who comes from an Orthodox background, Jared Kushner, and he's married to a woman who was Megayer al pi halacha, from what I've heard. I mean, I'm not an expert in Geirus. You would have to ask. We've had Geirus experts here on the radio. But, you know, I understand that Rav Shechta, I heard, was on the Beis Din, so an Orthodox wife. And it brings its a whole host of halachic, you know, interesting questions. One of them being, you know, can somebody like that fly on Shabbos, drive on Shabbos, go to an inauguration on Shabbos, fly to Saudi Arabia on Shabbos? Give us a little bit of, I understand that you've spoken about this or written about this. Give us a little bit of what your opinion.
Okay, that's a tall order, but let's dive into it. I think it's important for people to understand that it's counterproductive for most of us to second guess other Yidden, especially from a distance, as if we can figure out what their nisyonos are and what the particulars are of the challenges that they face, or even of the conditions that might be matter things that we would never be matter for ourselves. Ivanka is certainly a giyaris lahalacha. I there's nothing for me to say after Rav Herschel Schechter, but it happens to be I am on a Geirus Beis Din, and I spent some time a couple of years ago speaking to the head of the Beis Din that was Megayer her. We can return to this a little bit later, Rav David, but one of the very interesting questions that emerges from this are what standards there are about Geirus when you're doing Geirus for a whole community, and when people come from parts of the community that have sometimes different halachic standards. You know, there's no question that Ivanka was a kosher giyaris, and that means that anything we say about her runs the risk of violating the issur of inui hager. And even without that, just to look for ways of saying, well, this guy's not everything that he's cracked up to be, that's really not our job. At the same time, it's very important for us, and I think you were referring to a statement that a group that I participate in called Torah, Traditional Orthodox Rabbis Association. It's a new rabbinic organization for rabbonim who are at the Orthodox center and right of center, because no one's really talking about current issues to the press and to the public. When the story emerged about the flight on Shabbos, we became concerned, and the concern turned out to be well-placed. We got reports of people who were approached by their employers who said, you know, why do you have to leave so early all the time? Why can you never be available on Shabbos? Can't you go to Ivanka's rabbi and he'll tell you it's okay? We can't expect the rest of America to understand halachic process. Even religious non-Jews, it's important to keep in mind, are part of faith systems that are not really legal systems like ours is. To know about the minutia of the law, to know about a lechachila and a b'diyevet, to know the difference between an isa d'oraisa and an isa d'rabbanan, is something we can't expect of the average American, of the average non-from Jew. That does put lots of Yidden in kind of danger, because they can be held up as counterexamples, unfavorably in their employers' eyes, to the flexibility of the not quite the first couple, but maybe the second couple of the realm. So we thought it was important for people to get the word out there, so that it could be quoted in the future, that anything that was told to the Kushners is not something that can be easily extrapolated to anybody else's position. Halacha is complex, and there are reasons why, especially if you were dealing with the Rabbanans, which I'm not saying we were, but there's a very big likelihood that many of the issues that have come up before were issues of the Rabbanans. And when you're talking about somebody who is leaned on by the president of the most important country in the world for advice, that there might be possibly room for somebody to have been mater. Nobody publicized what the Hertha was, but the key takeaways for us have to be that we should not be so judgmental. It's not helping our own ruchnius nor our relationship with the White House. And B, we do have to get the word out that halacha is variegated and complex, and that the heter for one person does not necessarily carry over to anybody else.
So you're saying, if I could, tell me if I got this right, what your concern was is that an employer shouldn't say, look, if a Jew could fly on Shabbos, why can't you go to Chicago for the sales meeting Friday night? We know now that it can be done and you could be Orthodox.
Exactly. And I don't think that employers would stop at just the traveling. I think they'd say, look, if they can fly, everybody knows that Orthodox Jews don't fly on Shabbos, why can't you be available for a teleconference? Or why can't you come into the office occasionally?
Therefore, it's important, rather counterintuitively, you're saying, pointing out that the difference in halacha between somebody sort of like just as a physician can operate on Shabbos, so clearly not because the laws of Shabbos are suspended for him, but because there is, you know, intricacies in the law. The same thing, there are intricacies in the law for somebody who's in a position where very often people's lives can be contingent on their behavior.
Exactly. And I think it's important to keep in mind that for many, many Americans, particularly those who have some kind of religious leaning, when they hear about a rabbi who permits something, they think in terms of their own faith, which could mean that they got a dispensation from someone. And then the question is, well, if you shop around, then you can get a dispensation also. They're not into the idea of halacha being an objective system. At the same time, I think it's important for all of us not to bandy around ideas in halacha without some firm basis. There's a Beis Yosef in Yerideya and Kufayin Ches. It makes it very, very clear that the idea of korov lamalchus, of a person who is close to the seat of temporal power, that idea, which the Gemara in Sota uses in a couple of applications, and it is mentioned in Shas a few other places, is not a matir for a d'oraisa. It can't tell us that something which is an isa d'oraisa is mutter. The most that it could do is perhaps mater the rabbanan. That's the implication of the
But the Kesef Mishnah argues, you know that.
No.
Yeah, the Kesef Mishnah. I'm sitting in my office. I don't have a Rambam in front of me. I believe it's in Ilchus Yud Beis of Avodah Zarah. It's on argues. In other words, the shaila was how was it Ruvain Astrolabis able to. The Gemara says he dressed in the clothing of or in the midrash of an idolater, which is v'chukaseim loyseleichu. How was he allowed to do it? Ayitzanisa daraisa. So one answer is that the minutia of v'chukaseim loyseleichu is not described in the Torah, and it's biyad
chachamim.
Right. And that's the second teretz of the Kesef Mishnah, which is I believe what the Beis Yosef brings, but the first teretz of the Kesef Mishnah is that Hatzolos Nefashis is Shani. And the Gemara Taka says over there that, what did they do? They were geyser three things. They were geyser, I think the Gemara says, on Nida, they were on Mikvah, they were geyser on Shabbos, and they were geyser on Mila. So clearly, there are Jews who are not going to be Mechal Shabbos, who are going to maul their kids, and it would have caused the death. So was Hatzolos Nefashis? Hatzolos Nefashis Shani. So here's an interesting thing. I said a vart, I think it was a few weeks ago, and I got a haskam on the vart from a few people. I asked the question, if the chiddush of the halacha of the mechaben kufayin ches or the Rambam that somebody's karav lamalchus could be over an issa deraisa of b'chukaseim because of Hatzolos Nefashis, why do we need a special halacha to tell us that al tatzolos nefashis you could be either b'chukaseim leiseleicho al karav lamalchus? Any time as tatzolos nefashis you could be either kashrus, Shabbos, Mila, anything except gemar averus chamurus. You could be either b'makom tatzolos nefashis. Why do we need a special halacha to tell us that? So I said it. I would say that the svara would be that it's telling you that a karav lamalchus always has a din of Hatzolos Nefashis. that a Karav L'Malchus is Bechefza, a din of Hatzalas Nefashis. Even though there's a famous Noid de Behuda and a Binyan scene that talks about, can you be Matzel, can you be Oiv Shabbos on Hatzalas Nefashis on the La'asid?
Right.
And the Noid de Behuda says, no, it has to be Mamish Lefanecha, otherwise every doctor would be able to practice on Shabbos when he's a student. Medical schools should be able to be open, and we have a Fruma medical school, Turo, you should be open Shabbos, that's all of the fashis. Every doctor is going to save lives, without a doubt. So Noid de Behuda says it has to be Lefanecha to have a din of Atzal of the fashis. So the Chiddush of Karav L'Malchus is a Karav L'Malchus is always a din of Atzal of the fashis, even if the Atzal of the fashis is not Lefanecha.
So I'm not sure that we should be debating halacha on the radio, but I thought that shita actually was more machmir than the other shitas, and that the chiddush was that even though the aveira that he was performing by dressing like a non-Jew was not immediately part of the hatzala and only ancillary to it, that because it's tzomud, it's tied in to an inyan of Hatzalas Nefashas, that is the matir, and that is why it's a special chiddush, and why it's not the usual halacha of pikuach nefesh being docha and isur in the Torah. I believe I have seen in the Achronim those who say that teretz actually is more machmir than the others. I know la halacha we usually go with one of the other terutzim, the one that the Bach brings in his own name, not citing the Marik directly, but he pretty much says the same as the Maharik, that the isur of Bechukos Sehem doesn't apply to a Karav L'Malchus because he's not dressing lehizdamos. He's not dressing in order to look more like a non-Jew than a Jew. But look, I have no objection if you're right, but I think Olecha Lahavi Raya, and that you want to write a piece of Torah?
I'm just saying a Kesef Mishnah that even though the Beis Yosef doesn't bring it, but the Kesef Mishnah is somebody you could be Simach on.
Perhaps, but I think we can debate whether
And I would add on to it that a Jew going to Saudi Arabia, right, which is just received from the Trump administration $100 billion of arms, but historically is a very well armed, you know, dangerous and powerful country that is a direct neighbor to Eretz Yisrael and could be a very dangerous and potent enemy. And a young fellow like this going there and meeting the new crown prince, etc., and shaking his hand and looking him in the eye and knowing him and being able to pick up the call. I'm not a paisik, ich bin ishkinrav, ich bin agrab, balabas, and amaretz. But if you would ask me, I would say that I can't think of a bigger example of Karav L'Malchus and Atzalas Nefashis than that. And I would say that it would be Mata Shabbos. It would be Mata. You know, it's as much as Reuven ben Astrolabis was able to do to going to meet the crown prince of Saudi Arabia and spending a few hours with him. And again, I wasn't asked. But I can't think of a stronger example of Atzalas Nefashis in Karav L'Malchus.
It could be, as you know, one of his compatriots, also working for the United States government, did not venture out of his hotel room on Shabbos. He came before and he sat there and he had his matzah crackers or something over Shabbos and resumed the talks afterwards. Again, I don't think that you or I should be second guessing what the decision was of the Kushners. It's important for us to realize that there are limitations on Karav L'Malchus. There might be more flexibility than most of us are willing to say. Maybe there's less, but that's not our job. And what we say in public about a couple as important as that, aside from the Isurim involved, the Vinu Eger or just being Motzi Shemra on somebody, has pragmatic effects as well. So we should be more careful about some of the things that we say in public.
Can I just say a story? And I apologize if I have the names wrong, but it was either Rav Abramsky or Rav Schneider. I don't remember who was, one of the two, that they brought a kinder transport over from Germany to England. I don't remember where I saw this, but I saw the Maisa, and it was an Adam Gadol. and they came on Shabbos, and it was a question, it was Mesupik, whether they would take the children and bring them to the wrong places, etc. And somebody said, "It. What should he do?" He says, "What do you mean? Bring me a telephone. I'm going to call right now and tell them what was on Shabbos." He said, it's pikuach nefesh. I mean, I can't think of having a relationship with somebody that powerful, such an incredible, you know, a historic enemy of Eretz Yisrael. To me, that's I don't know. It's
possible. Remember, though, Reb David, that in order to make the case for pikuach nefesh, you're talking about pikuach nefesh of Yidden, of Klal Yisrael, and that is one step removed here. I'm not sure. Again, I don't know what the conversation was like and why it was pressing. I suspect that Jared had to be there more because we have a president who's not the most experienced in foreign affairs and leans very heavily on his advisors, as he should. So he wanted him there. It's just as possible that any heter that he received had more to do with the fact that he could get on the plane before Shabbos and be Iker we paskin. I think Rov Rishonim paskin that ain't chum in lemaila meyasara, and that there's no really sederis involved. To say that a Karav Malchus always has a free pass at any kind of
Shabbos. It's dangerous. It's
very dangerous. The note of Yehuda's get there is accepted, is mekubal in halacha to the best of my knowledge, right and left all the time. So many nafka minas about how we're magdir pikuach nefesh, and note of Yehuda usually wins out. It's held its own for hundreds of years.
Let me ask you another question, Rabbi Adelstein. Do you think it's appropriate for us as Fruma people to be examining? I mean, is it really our business, house, like, is it our geschäft, what he does and who he does? It's almost like he's being held up as like some paragon of halacha, and it's Maisa Rav. To me, there's something that strikes a dissident chord about that.
I agree 1,000%. Let me tell you a little bit of a beautiful, beautiful zog from a Avigdor Nevinzal Shlita, the Talmud Chaver of Rav Shlomo Zalman, who learned with him b'chavrusa for many, many years. He's the Rav of the Rova in Yerushalayim and writes beautiful, beautiful sichas on the Parsha, beautiful Torah, and Moedim, and is a big Baal Halacha in Yerushalayim. And somebody once asked him about being down people a kapschus, and he said, "Rebbe, but you know, like sometimes the evidence is just so strong in the other direction. So, like, what do you do then? What do you do then when it's impossible? There's no suffik hashakol. It's not even note on one side. It's just so overwhelming. Like, how do you down a person lekapskus then?" So he thought for a second and he said, "Who says that you have to be done? You don't always have to make judgment calls about the behavior of other people. It's not a great midah. It doesn't do great things for our ruchnias." And you'll probably save wear and tear on your stomach linings if you do it a little less often. It's not our business to decide whether they're right, whether they're wrong, whether they're paragons of virtue, or whether they're slipping, whether they're acting on a lower level of halacha, a higher level of halacha. We should be concerned with what's right for ourselves and how we're going to represent what they do to the rest of the community when it impacts on our own interests. And we should be doing it in a way that doesn't antagonize some very, very powerful people.
Well, Rabbi Adelstein, thank you very much. And it was really an honor and a pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you. It was great being here.
Enjoyed this program. Remember, go out and buy Headlines 2. It's the most fascinating English halacha sefer you will buy this year. It will make you one of the more interesting people at the table. A wonderful week.